Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Our guest for most of this hour has a fascinating background. He was assistant commissioner in Abbottabad many, many years ago. He was schooled there, so in a recent interview he said he knows the area. This is an area where any building being constructed has to pass through the architecture, the building, the ownership, through regular bureaucratic procedures, which means people would know who's living in the building, and a building that size so near the military academy would have bound to raise all kinds of suspicions, especially the kind of characters coming and going from the building. So it's highly unlikely, he says, that the authorities didn't know who was in that building, which raises the question, if they knew about who was in the building, why at this particular time was this operation allowed, as it were, to proceed? Because I don't believe Pakistan had no idea about the operation. Our guest for a good chunk of this hour is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He is currently the chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, the first distinguished chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy, Annapolis, and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's taught at Princeton, Harvard, and Cambridge universities and has been called the world's leading authority on contemporary Islam by the BBC. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, and other U.S. agencies on Islam and foreign policy. He is the author of over a dozen award-winning books, including Discovering Islam, which was the basis of the BBC six-part TV series titled Living Islam. He's also author of the full-length documentary Journey into America and The Challenge of Islam. And he is with us, and his knowledge of this particular part of Pakistan is very deep. Later this hour, the chief correspondent for the New York Times, who will be joining us from Islamabad, she is the chief correspondent for Pakistan. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Ambassador Ahmed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you for that very warm introduction.
Well, you are just such a wonderful person to speak with because you know this area. You know this area. You went to school in this area.
Kathleen, I not only went to the school, it was a school run by Catholic priests called Burn Hall, very famous school in Pakistan. One of my class fellows went on to become president. One was an ambassador here in Washington. So it's a good school, well known. And also, my first posting as assistant commissioner in charge of the administration, I was under training then, was in Abbottabad. So I really know the area and the history. And incidentally, Kathleen, this is the first time I'm mentioning this, no disrespect here, but the pronunciation is Abbottabad because the word comes from Abbott, which is an English name. The town was named after James Abbott, who was a deputy commissioner, very famous and popular deputy commissioner, in the mid-19th century when the British Raj ruled this part of Pakistan. And I know that a lot of people here are confused with the name because they assume it's a local name. Abad means the settlement of. So it is a tribute to the memory of James Abbott.
Oh. Abbottabad.
Yes, Abbottabad. You got it right.
Okay.
You may now tell all your colleagues in the media that they're getting it wrong.
I'll do just that.
Please tell Anderson Cooper and everyone. They keep saying Abbottabad and all sorts of names, and it puzzles a lot of people.
Okay. Well, you've said something here that's very thought-provoking. You said in a recent interview you don't believe Pakistan had no idea about this operation, which raises all kinds of questions. Why would they have allowed us to proceed?
Kathleen, several answers suggest themselves. First of all, we are in the middle of this discovery of the operation and the controversy and the debate and all the issues that are being raised. We really are in the middle of it. And no one really has all the facts. They're all a bit murky. Their people have their hypotheses. And there's a kind of emotion and anger around the whole operation, both on both sides. There's a lot of questions being asked in America, right, absolutely correct questions. Why didn't you tell us if you knew? How could you have been hiding this guy? And so on. in Pakistan, there's also a lot of anger that you're supposed to be allies. You've breached our national sovereignty. Your drone strikes are killing civilians every day, and so on. And a critical relationship, a critical alliance, is now very, very much under strain. So that's number one. So there's no way of giving you a sure answer. We can only use our own common sense. My common sense is, knowing the area, knowing the institutions in Pakistan, that it is highly, highly unlikely that the most wanted man in the world, the number one man on the FBI's terrorist list, is living in this huge house, not a very pretty house, not a very luxurious house, but a very prominent-looking house, conspicuous-looking house, a stone's throw from the Pakistan Military Academy, which is the only training center for the Pakistan military. And Abbottabad is also the garrison center for three regiments, which means the entire place, it has a very military atmosphere. It's a beautiful town. It's up in the hills. It's a hill resort. A lot of tourists come there. And when they're not there, then you have all these soldiers marching around. Now, it's highly unlikely that none of them then picked up on this man. So therefore, my thesis would be that the Pakistan government had some idea at some stage, and Mrs. Osama bin Laden says that they were there for 6 to 7 years, which means they were there for some time. It's obvious that he was sort of constrained there. There was not much movement. Apparently, she said we were locked up in the top room, the room where he was killed. And then the level of cooperation between American and Pakistani intelligence is very high. And they, again, you can read between the lines that there was some kind of cooperation. I think the Pakistan Prime Minister in his speech yesterday to Parliament said the same thing. He said it was our clues given by the ISI to American intelligence, which led them to the Americans to Osama bin Laden a few days ago. So again, the full story will come out. But the fact that the Pakistan Prime Minister keeps saying that we had no idea and that the authorities, the intelligence and so on, were completely in the dark about his whereabouts. And he was trying to persuade both Pakistan and the world. And I don't think he did a very convincing job in Parliament yesterday. I can understand the caution, Kathleen, and your listeners need to listen to this point also. In Pakistan, unfortunately, and I repeat the word unfortunately, violence and militancy now is so prevalent that the mosques have been attacked, schools have been attacked, buses are being attacked, government officials and government buildings are being attacked, and with impunity. Law and order seems to have collapsed from the time I was there. The result is that public figures are very, very, very scared about doing anything in public that would go against the mood of the country. When the governor of the Punjab, the most important official of that whole province, was assassinated by a militant, the president of Pakistan, Zardari, whose party the governor belonged to, did not go to his funeral services. He was that scared. So now think of it. Put yourself in that context. In that environment, high anti-Americanism, high anger in the public, for any politician or leader to say, well, of course, we knew all about this operation and we supported the American operation. If they say that, it's like committing suicide. So I can understand the leaks coming out that at some level there was a kind of tacit agreement that the Americans will say, look, it's entirely our show. You guys let us down. And the Pakistanis will say, of course, we didn't know anything about it. This is entirely an American show.
But Ambassador Ahmed, you can't live that way forever. The truth, you have to be honest eventually, don't you?
You're absolutely right, Kathleen, and one of the reasons I constantly get in trouble, I'll share this with your listeners, with Pakistanis, is because I believe in exactly that. Let me give you a small example to tell you how bad the situation is. I made a film and I wrote a book and made a documentary on Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan. And he's a man, a name that your listeners should remember. He's the founding father of Pakistan, and his vision for Pakistan was a modern Muslim state based in human rights, women's rights, minority rights. His first two speeches in 1947 when the country was made are based in this vision. And his minister, the president of the Constituent Assembly, was a Hindu, a minority member. And the first thing he did when the state was founded was to attend a church to again show the minorities that, you know, you're absolutely safe here, you'll be honored here, and you're part of this country. That was his vision. This was the big vision he had. But alas, Kathleen, over the last few decades, that vision has been hammered and hammered and into a corner, and I'm not sure how much of that vision remains. So anyway, I wanted to revive that vision, a modern democratic state. In the 1990s, when I was at Cambridge University in England, I made a feature film, you know, with Christopher Lee, the famous actor, Hollywood actor,
sure,
who played Jinnah. And Lee says, by the way, this was his greatest role. Do you know that I was attacked in public? There were processions against me. And there was, you know, absolutely, I was being slandered and attacked, and people were saying, how dare you? And I was being threatened. People actually tried to stop the film because they said, and listen to this, because they said, you are going to show Jinnah as a modernist, a man who's talking about women's rights and human rights and showing that he's very tolerant to Hindus and minorities. And that is not how Jinnah was. Jinnah was a fanatic, and he had a sword in one hand and the Quran in the other hand. And then they said, if you show his daughter, because he had a daughter, Kathleen, who in fact married a non-Muslim. And Jinnah, you know, then had very strained relations with her. And they said, if you show the daughter, your life will not be safe.
Oh, my goodness.
It was that bad. And I was in Pakistan filming for a couple of weeks with this whole crew. I had James Fox, another famous actor. I had Christopher Lee. I mean, these are top stars. We were going through a very, very tough time because there was this irrational, emotional backlash against touching the foundational myth of Pakistan. So what I'm trying to tell you is there's a battle taking place within Pakistan, and it is violent and it is dangerous. And in that environment, and I was filming over 10 years ago, just think if someone stood up and said, yes, we were involved with this operation to take out Osama bin Laden. You can imagine the violent background, so backlash. So I agree with you. We are deceiving ourselves in Pakistan. Pakistanis need to be ruthlessly honest with the problems they face, take them on, and then ask their allies, their friends, the Americans, to say, okay, these are our priorities. Help us with our challenges, with our educational system, with our judicial system, with our administrative system, so we can strengthen the structures of a modern Muslim state. And not given to these irrational emotions. If you do, we only end up by fooling ourselves.
And how do you, in the meantime, deal with all of those people? And I guess it's a substantial number of people who have such entirely irrational thoughts.
Kathleen, it's a complicated question. Again, in my books, I've tried to address this. You see, it's complicated because it is precisely the failure of the modernist vision, of Jinnah's vision, that collapses in the 1980s and 90s, which allows a vacuum to be created, and you get all this nonsense and irrational violence into that vacuum. When I was growing up in Abbottabad in the 50s and 60s, Kathleen, believe me, it was a different Pakistan. My teachers were Catholics. Think of it. It's individual Catholics living in Abbottabad, highly respected figures. I've seen, important ministers and industrialists quaking in their boots in front of these priests. Why? Because there was tremendous respect for learning, for the fact that they're in Pakistan teaching their kids. Then I went to Foreman Christian College in Lahore, a college run by Presbyterian American teachers this time. And again, tremendous respect. And even today, with all the chaos in Pakistan, Foreman Christian College survives and flourishes. And again, two of my contemporaries went on to become president. So it's not a marginal college. My point is that there's a battle, a very intense battle taking place. And if the modernists of Pakistan fail, you will have the whole state becoming supporters of violent militants. And that is the danger, because Pakistan is, Kathleen, and I want your listeners to hear very carefully, a critical state for the United States of America. It is 180 million people. It's not tiny like Afghanistan or Iraq. It is nuclear. It is at a critical geopolitical location. On the east is China. In the south is India. In the north is Afghanistan. And on beyond that is Russia. To the west is Iran. Each one of these countries is vital for American foreign policy. So you see how critical Pakistan is.
Yes.
And therefore, unless we understand Pakistan, Kathleen, unless we understand the dynamics in the country, we may end up by pushing in a certain direction with good sense and with good faith, but be counterproductive in what we do in Pakistan itself.
The New York Times today has a story which indicates that we also are playing along with what may not be the truth here. President Obama insisted, I'm reading here, that the assault force hunting down bin Laden be large enough to fight its way out of Pakistan if confronted by hostile local police officers and troops. According to information released yesterday, the planning, the article goes on to say, illustrates how little the administration trusted the Pakistanis as they set up their operation. They also rejected a proposal to bring the Pakistanis in on the mission. Is that less than the truth, do you think?
Again, I think I would agree with this because President Obama staked everything on this. This really was his turning point. As you're seeing from the tremendous bump he's got in the polls, this was a turning point. The night he demolishes poor Donald Trump at that dinner, the correspondence
yes.
in Washington, and then just goes on to kill Osama bin Laden. You know, this was a turning point. So therefore, he had to do everything possible to make sure this mission succeeded. And one of the things that he would have done is to make sure that these the Navy SEALs who went in for this very difficult mission, very, I would say one of the boldest missions in military history, to make sure that they succeeded. So yes, there would be that. At the same time, Kathleen, many questions again. The C-130 plane that apparently flew from Tarbela, which is an American base given by the Pakistanis, leased by them to Americans to use, which is not too far from Abbottabad. Now, the C-130 that flew from that base would have only flown with the full clearance by the Pakistan Air Force. So, again, someone needed to know, and someone needed to have, there's always a backup in any military operation. You need a backup. And it's leaking already that the Pakistan Army was giving that backup. So I think the story will slowly unfold so that the anger in Pakistan is not like an explosion.
I see.
I suspect this is what is happening. But at the same time, if this is what is happening, then the anger in the street in both countries is now running at dangerous levels. There's a lot of questions being asked, and those questions are not really being answered by the authorities.
Why is there so much anger in the streets in Pakistan, and we have a completely different cry for democracy or for a change in government in Egypt and Tunisia and Syria? Why is it so different?
You know, Kathleen, I have been writing about this for at least two decades, and people analyze this very differently. What I've been saying is this, because I'm an anthropologist, so I look at it from the worm's eye point of view, that is right from the village level or the suburb level, rather than the eagle's eye view, which is what the political scientist does.
Mm-hmm.
They use theories. They say, you know, this is Marxism or this is Islamism or this is somethingism. Now, my theories are based on the fact that if the ordinary person in the suburb or the village or the town is unhappy, he doesn't have a job, he is illiterate, he doesn't have any prospects for the future, he sees corruption around him, he sees how his rulers are living. They're living in these huge white mansions. He knows that they've made this money out of some deal or the other. He knows that if he even speaks against them, he'll be picked up and tortured, that the secret police is everywhere. And he knows that America has been giving billions of dollars to his government for him. Ultimately, America wants to help the allies in the Muslim world, and the allies like Egypt or Pakistan get a lot of money from America. And he says, I have not even got $1 out of this. These rich people, these rich rulers of mine have creamed it off and are eating it up, and I am literally on the verge of starvation. It's a very desperate situation. And what that means is, Kathleen, that there's an explosion waiting to happen. You saw the explosion in Egypt, Tunisia, and so on. And in Pakistan, it's a slow-motion explosion. So a lot of this anger is coming from the quality of their lives. And it was not always like this, Kathleen. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was a different Pakistan. Believe me, let me give you a story that will really, really encourage your listeners. Jackie Kennedy, beautiful, elegant, arrives in Pakistan. Now visualize this, Kathleen, in your mind. Jackie Kennedy, this beautiful and elegant lady, standing in an open car in Lahore alongside the president of Pakistan, surrounded by hundreds of Pakistanis. And pause, what are they doing? Are they shrieking down with America, death to America, death to the great Satan? They're not. They're throwing flower petals at her. they're grinning, and you know, there's a tremendous atmosphere of, they really fell in love with her. And then she goes on to Peshawar, the home, you know, where the target of all the Taliban attacks in the frontier province, near the tribal areas. And there, they just go crazy about her. So this picture of Jackie in Lahore, which I published in my most recent book, Journey into America, it's a remarkable picture. This tells us something. It tells us that there was a time when Pakistanis had very, very strong emotions, very affectionate emotions for America. So I would say that this anti-Americanism is skin deep. It is not very, very deep, and it can be turned. Internally, the modernists must succeed in creating a modern Muslim state, and externally, Americans need to understand that this is an important relationship. We've had good times. We've had a strong alliance in the past. It's now shaky, and we need to get it back on even keel.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have time for a few. Our guest for about 10 more minutes is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He is now professor in the School of International Service and chair of Islamic Studies at American University. He's also at the U.S. Naval Academy. He is former Pakistani ambassador to the United Kingdom. He is the author of, after listening to him speak, I want to get this book right away, don't you? Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam is his latest book. He also did a number of documentaries, TV series, Living Islam. And he, very important to our conversation, was schooled in the very part of Pakistan where Osama bin Laden was killed. Here's our phone number. Time for a couple calls for the ambassador, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Later this hour, we'll speak with a chief correspondent for the New York Times who's joining us from Islamabad and ask more about anti-Americanism and her views on the amount of anti-Americanism she's seeing and whether or not, as the ambassador suggests, it can be turned. If so, how? I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, I've admired him in his work for many, many years now. Alan Arkin will join us. He has a new book. It's his memoir, An Improvised Life. And he bases his whole career, really, on what he learned at Second City in Chicago. He was part of the first group there in 1960. So that will be a joy to talk to him. We welcome phone calls. Ambassador Akbar Ahmed is with us. The first part of our program, Habu in Madison, is our first caller. Hello.
Yes, hello, and good morning to you and your guests. Very good to listen to you. I just have one very quick comment, and probably would charge your assertion that this is skin deep. Now, truth be told, I'm not a Pakistani. I've not been there, and I don't know it as well as you do. But let me say this: there is, people are impoverished in the lower tiers of society worldwide, even this country. So this is nothing new. But this is also seen as, you know, the imposition of IMF and structural adjustments, etc., which go much deeper to the bone. And that coupled with a somewhat sadistic zeal that America has exhibited in, whether in Iraq before the war, you know, the sanctions, or 500,000 lives, it's worth it, comment, etc., etc. This is all stoking, working together with this this poverty to create a tsunami, I think. I don't know.
All right, let's get a response. Ambassador.
Yes, I think Habu's basically confirming what I said, Kathleen, that there is a sense of a desperation almost in Pakistan today, and I'm keeping the focus on Pakistan, and it's reflected in many other parts of the world. We can blame our leaders in those countries. They have been, and you're seeing this, Kathleen, you're seeing this on your television screens. You're seeing these, I mean, I don't know how to describe, psychopaths like Gaddafi and this fellow in Syria. They're shooting their civilians through their tanks, and they're using their helicopters and air force to actually shoot down and mow down their civilians. And this has been going on for months and months. We're seeing this on our television. They're taking them into the hospitals, the doctors treat them, and then the doctors are picked up and tortured. That is the kind of society that Muslims are living in, and that is an internal challenge. They have to come to terms with modernity, with the 21st century, and again go back to a vision of a modern Muslim state. Without that, this internal tension is going to continue to boil. The United States has to be constantly aware not to get involved in local battles, not to get involved in that at all, and also to push towards a greater vision which reflects its own vision, the vision of the founding fathers, of education, of knowledge, of living with civility, words and ideas that are reflected in the Declaration and in the Constitution. Now, if that is picked up in the Muslim world and that is entirely compatible with the Muslim vision of a modern society, I think that the two can do business.
What do you make of the drone strikes, Ambassador Ahmed?
Kathleen, the drone strikes are causing a lot of anger and unrest. And according to Colonel David Kilcullen, the great authority on counterterrorism, he's the main expert advising the American Army, 98% of the drone strikes hit the target that is not intended, which means they're killing women and children and so on. 2% hit some kind of, you know, mid-level or whatever target. Now, again, you have to balance this. Is it worth it? Is it not worth it? If we get these two guys and then we kill 98% people who are completely innocent, their wedding parties or people sitting together to have a cup of tea or have a meeting, and the anger that stokes both in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So again, you have to offset this because again and again, Pakistani and Afghan political leadership may look the other way, to honor their alliance with America. But the anger in the public of both these countries, the anger is again fed into the larger anger against America.
Thanks, Habu, for your call. Dennis and Racine, hi.
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 I was wondering if the guest could speak to the problem many Pakistanis have with India over Kashmir. And it's my opinion that when a nation or when nationalists feel disenfranchised and nothing is and their leadership is asking for the return of some land, and I'm also thinking of the Israeli Palestinian problem, when they get nowhere, that's what really feeds terrorism, and we could stop terrorism if some countries would just be a little more generous, a little more willing to negotiate over this disputed territory.
Dennis, you're a wise man. You've answered your own question. You're absolutely right. When you talk to Palestinians or Kashmiris, they will say that, look, we have been fighting for our rights now for half or over half a century. The United Nations has passed resolutions. So it is in the interest of everyone. It is in the interest of Israelis and Palestinians to solve their problem, and in the interest of Pakistanis and Indians, which includes parts of Kashmir, because Kashmir has been divided into sort of two halves, to resolve their problems so that the people of Kashmir can begin to live normal lives. You're absolutely right. When people are desperate, you have a situation where they're prepared to do anything violent. You have, according to the statistics, something like 100,000 civilians who have been killed in Kashmir, and you had three wars between India and Pakistan. And I'm not saying that Kashmiris will automatically say we want to vote for Pakistan as against India. All I'm saying is that Indian leaders and Pakistani leaders really need to be much more responsible. And the word Dennis used, which is to be generous with these minorities and say, you're part of us, you're part of our peoples. We're going to resolve your problems. You can live like us and join the table, rather than use the army and police and so on. And the stories of rape and torture are really terrible. And unless that changes, Dennis, you're right, the situation on the ground is not going to change.
Thanks, Dennis, for the call. Two more things I want to make sure I get to with you. I know you're a busy guy. You have said that Pakistan has got to take on the Taliban and the militant, and those militants are seeping into the administrative structure. How should they be taking on the Taliban, and how have they seeped into the militants, the administrative structure in Pakistan?
Kathleen, if they don't take on the militants, the people of violence, the state of Pakistan will effectively be destroyed. It's like a cancer. You have to take, I would say, take them on at base. Go back to the education system, the madrasa system. Where are these people being educated? Ask your correspondent in Islamabad. Have the madrasas been reformed? They have not. So the millions of little boys were coming out of these madrasas. And remember, madrasas by per se, by definition, not a bad thing. It just means a school. Now, that school is continuing to produce kids who've got a very narrow understanding of the world. That needs reform, the madrasa system. And if we now are able to put some of the very generous aid we're giving Pakistan into madrasas, into teachers' training programs, into syllabi, into new curriculums, into scholarships for the kids to, you know, get out of the area and meet the rest of the world, computers. Overnight, you're going to change the way people think, and in the long term, you're going to change the very direction of this nation. Nothing has changed. I asked President Musharraf this a couple of years back when I was visiting Pakistan for another project with some American students of mine, and I wrote a book called Journey into Islam about the madrasas, and he said that Dick Cheney had been pressurizing him, close the madrasas, and he said, if I close them overnight, you will have literally millions of kids out there fighting the jihad against Americans. So he said, I'm going to reform them. And of course, he didn't reform them. So right now, we need to be thinking long-term. We need to be thinking holistic. Because if we don't, the danger of 180 million people then veering towards closer and closer towards the militants' understanding of the world will sooner or later have an impact on us.
You also write about, and we can certainly see the negative effects of this in other parts of the world, including in our country, that what's going on is also kind of a class war, a class confrontation taking place in Pakistan, and it's quite serious.
It is. Again, this is something completely overlooked. To a lot of Pakistanis or Egyptians or Tunisians, they are actually fighting a slow-motion class war. It's got nothing to do with America or the world. It's fighting, literally in the classic sense, a war for the entire class to have a better chance at survival, to have a bigger piece of the cake. And the stories coming out of Pakistan simply confirm that for me.
Okay. Can you take one more phone call? You can be honest with me.
Of course, Kathleen.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Kathleen, I'm off to give a luncheon talk to the AARP in Washington. So that's an organization I have a lot of respect for. So that's my next appointment.
Well, you can be back with us any old time.
You're
a
marvelous
guest. David in Kansasville will be our final caller, although we'll take calls for the New York Times correspondent, too. Hi, David.
Good morning. My question is, what do you say to the argument that the Pakistani military supports terrorism against India to justify and its own existence amongst its people?
David, again, a very important question, because Pakistanis think like this. And again, you need to get into the mind of people you're relating to. Pakistan was created in 1947. 2 million people died, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, just going berserk, killing each other. 15 million people were displaced. This was the largest migration in human history. Now, Pakistan, therefore, grew up with this paranoia. I would use the word paranoia about India. A bigger neighbor, 1 to 10 in terms of population, a huge neighbor, an emerging military and economic power, and, of course, doing very well. India is doing something we can all be proud of. But for Pakistanis, there have been 3 wars. And therefore, when Pakistan feels this sense of insecurity, its only blanket of security, like the Peanuts character, is actually the Pakistan Army. So invariably, in a crisis, it will fall back to the idea that we will be finally the final barrier that will prevent India from overrunning us will be the Pakistan Army. And therefore, the Pakistan Army becomes a sort of sacred cow in Pakistan. Literally, they can do, you know, all kinds of things and get away with it. And unfortunately, David, the Pakistan Army, first-class army, one of the best in the region, has got too involved with politics. It's got involved with all sorts of business and economic ventures. The generals are making lots of money and having big plots. And, of course, not all generals are doing this, but a lot of them are. And therefore, even this reputation, which is tarnished, is put aside when Pakistanis say, but this is the only institution that's going to save us from India. Therefore, you're absolutely right that Pakistanis will point out, as they do, that we've lost 30 to 40,000 Pakistanis killed. Think of it. It's 10 times more than on 9/11.
Yes.
As a result of 9/11. And Americans still say we haven't done enough. It wasn't our war on terror. We weren't involved on 9/11. Not a single terrorist was from Pakistan of the 19. And yet we are being accused of. This is what they will say. And they will say our real threat is in India. And as we are speaking, Kathleen, you are seeing these tectonic plates beginning to shift. You have the Prime Minister of Pakistan flying to China just now. You have Indian troops, 20,000 troops moving up to the borders on the south. Ask your correspondent in Islamabad about this. And again, this is feeding into the sense of insecurity in Pakistan. And I've said this, Pakistan is like a chemical. And what you don't want to do with a chemical, I remember from my chemistry days when the priest would come and give me a slap on the head for being so bad in the subject, was you don't shake it around because the damn thing blows up. So you've got to bring some calm and stability to a very shaky nation. And therefore, David, understanding these issues becomes vital for us.
Yes, and it creates a sense of insecurity in the world, certainly, not
exactly,
just in that
because,
region.
You know, it is nuclear for better or for worse. It is nuclear, and that
right.
means that if something terrible happens, that I mean, the nightmare, Kathleen, the ultimate nightmare is the nuclear program falls. It won't fall into the hands of the militants, as some people think here, but it could fall into the hands of army officers who think like the militants or who are sympathetic to the militants. That scenario will change the balance of power because if they team up with Iran, if they team up with Hezbollah and so on, you can imagine, just take a look at the map of the world. Everything changes.
Yes. Well, you are absolutely fascinating. Please join us again. I've learned so much, and I'd love to be in the audience for your AARP luncheon today.
Kathleen, my dear, you're too young for that group.
No, I'm not.
Thank you
but
so
thank
much.
You. I like you even more. Thank you very much for all of your knowledge.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you.
Our guest for a good chunk of this show, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He is chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, and other U.S. agencies on Islam and foreign policy. He was Pakistani ambassador to England, and I found it fascinating, once served as an assistant government commissioner in Abbottabad, where he spent a good deal of time, and he was schooled in that part of the world as well, so he knows the whole territory. Fascinating man. We are going to find out what's going on in Pakistan today. The chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan, Jane Perlez, will be joining us as we continue on this Tuesday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, Alan Arkin, will be joining us. His life is now in print, a memoir, and the book is An Improvised Life. Joining us now from Islamabad is the chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan. Jane Perlez is here. Jane, thank you very, very much for being with us this morning. Hello.
That's a pleasure. Good morning.
Let me ask you, we just had the former ambassador to England with us, who was fascinating. It made me think about wanting to know more about the extent of anti-Americanism, the demonstrations, et cetera, that you're seeing right now. It was his belief that that sentiment could be turned. How widespread is it? What are you seeing on the streets?
Oh, the demonstrations are not that much at the moment, but the anti-American sentiment is very strong, and I disagree with him. I think it'll be very hard to reverse it.
And why do you think the anti-American sentiment is so strong?
Because many Pakistanis feel that the war in Afghanistan, which has brought the turmoil and the terror attacks within Pakistan, they feel that the American presence in Afghanistan has made the militants in Pakistan much stronger. And also they feel, I think, a great sense of disappointment. The United States has promised aid, economic assistance to this country, and while dollars has been released by the Congress to be spent here in Afghanistan in the first year of a big, massive aid package, there's very little to see for it.
Where is the money going?
it's not being spent because the United States Agency for International Development, known as USAID, is finding it very difficult to find projects that satisfy their concerns about corruption, and they're finding it difficult to find projects that make a difference to Pakistanis' daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the death of bin Laden and the actions that took place to get him. What we're hearing here is that the Pakistanis are concerned that we entered their sovereign space. Are they getting a lot of those who are concerned about that support for their position? It's sort of hard from our perspective to say, well, we're sorry, but it was more important to get this guy.
Yes, it is interesting. The United States and Pakistan are supposed to be allies, but each country looks at this raid in a very different perspective. The Americans are totally puzzled that bin Laden could be hiding in almost plain sight in a small town not far from the capital for apparently 5 years. But the Pakistanis and Americans could come in on three or four helicopters, land, take him out, not be detected. And the Pakistani public feels let down by their vaunted military, that their military couldn't protect them better. Not that they're so much opposed to taking bin Laden. Many, many are opposed to that. What they feel is an infringement of their, as you say, their sovereignty, and they feel, okay, well, maybe the Americans are somewhat friendly, but the Indians are not friendly. They're our neighbor and they're our enemy, and maybe they could do the same thing. So that is the concern.
Mm-hmm. And eventually we'll know, or maybe we won't know what actually happened, but there are reports now, and our last guest really believed that the Pakistanis knew about this, and they just sort of looked the other way, but they had to have known about it, and they had to have looked the other way when U.S. helicopters entered their airspace and just didn't do anything about it because they couldn't because of the militants who were pressuring them.
No, I don't think that's correct at all. I think the Americans flew very close to the ground. They were able to beneath the radar. There was no permission from the Pakistanis to do this raid, and the Pakistani military and the Pakistani spy agency is so upset. They were not forewarned.
He was talking about Indian troops. What do you know about the movement of troops right now?
There's some reports about yesterday about the Indians having some exercises, but I'm not expert on this. I think that militaries around the world have exercises all the time, and whether this was an exercise drawn up particularly hastily at this moment, I don't know. I really can't speak to that.
Jane, what about the Pakistani government taking on militants in their government? What's the way for that to happen? How can that happen to a much larger degree?
What do you mean about militants in that government? I'm not sure what you mean.
Militants pressuring the Pakistani government. You know, it seems to us that they're trying to play both sides of the fence here, that they have to appease that element because there are so many of them in the country. And on the other hand, there's a desire on the United States to make sure that they're taking a more active effort in weeding out those militants.
Well, the situation is that there are several kinds in Pakistan. There are what's known as Pakistani Taliban are intent on fighting the Pakistani government and the military. And those militants, the Pakistani government and military, are trying to fight, not always successfully, but they are putting resources against them. There's another kind of militant called the Afghan Taliban who are in North Waziristan, who the United States is very upset that the Pakistanis support. These are the Taliban across to Afghanistan and fight American and NATO troops. These Afghan Taliban by the Pakistani military do not fight Pakistan. They fight
I didn't hear that.
In Afghanistan. And there's very little chance that the Pakistanis will change their behavior towards those militants. They will continue to allow those militants to operate because they see them as perhaps valuable in a settlement in Afghanistan. I don't know. I know it's difficult for people to understand, but that's the situation.
And what about all of that? That's happened in the last week and a half. Do you think that it will, in some way, change our mission, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it will make it easier for the Obama administration to up the end game in Afghanistan, which is not to say that they're going to walk out tomorrow, but I think it will make it easier if they want, and I think it will make the calls in Congress harder, perhaps, for a drawdown in Afghanistan. I mean, it's certainly not mission accomplished, but it certainly will, I think, make it, as I said, easier for the administration to try and figure out an end game in Afghanistan.
We're going to welcome a couple of phone calls. The chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan is our guest right now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Don in West Salem, our first caller for you, Jane. Hi, Don.
Yes, good morning. I know they've been talking on the radio and TV about sending money to the Pakistanis or the Pakistan to help them. My suggestion is don't send money. Money is just an end means. I think what they should do is send them food, send them materials, building materials, agricultural type things. I think some of our poor billionaires that desperately need tax returns to survive should start some companies over there, building companies, different companies to help the people over there, and they could make themselves hire the people there to work for it.
Do we, Jane, need to address the issues of haves and have-nots in Pakistan? Would that be a better use of U.S. aid?
Well, people are not starving here. This is not a, you know, an impoverished African country. What is happening here is, though, that there is vast energy shortages, and people, the Pakistani nation, needs, you know, a big help in building dams, power stations, increasing their energy so that their industry can do better. They do have a vibrant textile industry. One thing the United States could do that I think, you know, thinking people about Pakistan both in the United States and here believe is that the United States could lower tariffs for Pakistani textiles. I mean, we do that for China. I mean, the Carolina textile industry is probably not what it was, so it's not as though we're going to be eating into American jobs. They're already gone. It would be eating into the imports of other countries, and lowering the tariffs on Pakistani textiles would do a lot for employment here, and for some reason, that's very hard to get through Congress, but it would be a very worthwhile thing to do.
Thank you, John. We have time for one more call. Susan in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi, Jane. Listen, I had a question about Ray Davis and whether he's the individual that recently there was a huge uproar about whether or not to grant him diplomatic immunity. And there was a great outcry from the citizenry about whether or not he should go free. I'm wondering if he was involved at all in the surveillance of bin Laden or that compound, or do you have any information about that?
I don't think so. He was operating out of a different part of the country, and I think the United States did have a, set up a safe house near the compound as of, you know, in the last few months or just in the period before the raid. And I think it was a very discreet, very different, you know, very, was manned by a different group of people. It was not, as far as I know and as far as most people think, was not involved in this bin Laden surveillance.
Thank you, Susan, very much for the call. Jane, thank you for your time today. We'll look forward to your continuing reporting. Jane Perlez, chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan. We're sorry that we were getting some problems with the phone line, but that's the way it is. We got most of it, didn't we? She was in transit on her way to Islamabad. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program and Rhonda Fanning as well. And thanks to Chrissy for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll make sure that we get Ambassador Ahmed with us again on this program sometime. Absolutely fascinating information. Please stay with us because we have a great hour coming up. This is the Ideas Network.